Chapter 5. He meant well by that reassurance, but it had very much the opposite effect on me. I nodded my leave, returned to my cabin, and explained to Ramos that it would help if he were to take a chair. The coronel needed no encouragement or assistance from me to swing his legs off the table. I watched him for signs of giddiness, but he seemed sure on his feet. "Sit down and I shall bandage your head anew. The wound has suppurated a little, but to no great concern."
"I have no need of further rest, Silas."
"The patient is always the least reliable witness in these matters. You're as bad as Dupin." He lifted his eyes to mine.
"Our mapmaker."
"I've insisted that the boy rest, but he will not. Is it Topolsky that drives him, sir?"
"In this instance, no. Dupin has only one master."
"Himself?"
"Mathematics. His mistress and his tyrant. Gambling, whoredom, and violence are the things that kill some men. For him, it will be numbers, I am sure of it. Numbers and symbols as deadly to his spirit as any addiction or vendetta. That said, I am in no position to judge another man's vocation."
"So long as he doesn't die on us before he has exhausted his usefulness," I said, before blinking at the unanticipated callousness of my own words. "If you can find a way to persuade him to rest, perhaps he will listen to you."
"I fear I may be just as bad a patient, Silas."
"But somewhat more agreeable company. Please heed my advice, and if it irks you to be confined here without occupation, then I shall gladly deputize you as my assistant surgeon."
"I know nothing of surgery."
"But I imagine you do know a thing or two about holding men down against their will."
"That I do," he said ruefully.
"It will likely not come to that, but let us hope for the best and prepare for the worst." He nodded his approval.
"A sound dictum in peace as in war."
When Ramos was seated, I redressed his scalp, nodding quietly at my own work, not out of any sense of vanity, but rather taking reassurance in seeing that I had risen to the demands of my calling. As always, the dichotomies of my profession loomed large in my thoughts. I had no desire to hurt or mutilate any of Demeter's men, but if their injuries called for my intervention, I would act with urgency and something not entirely divorced from enthusiasm. I would be depending on skills that were not only mine alone aboard the ship, so far as I knew, but which had been acquired through diligence and toil. Even though my training had been in the provincial schools of Plymouth rather than the hallowed institutes of London or Edinburgh, I considered myself the equal of any man when it came to the blade and the suture.
"You look contented, Silas,"
Ramos observed, as I thrust a clean sheet across the table. "I am in my element. This is the work I was created to do. All else is distraction."
"You exist only to save men."
He gave me a slow, approving nod.
"It is a nobler calling than my own."
A commotion on deck, a coordination of calls and shouts, signaled the weighing of Demeter's anchor. I felt a gradual alteration in the ship's motion as the wind gathered in whatever portion of the sails remained spread, and we sliced through the ice-pocked swell rather than rising and falling on it. Slowly, the angle of the sun's light, low and pale as it was, moved about my cabin as the ship pointed its bow at the inlet. Since my cabin was near the stern on the port side, I could see nothing of our intended destination, but only the more distant northern extremities of the cliff. Seated at my bureau and making a preliminary entry into the medical log, reporting our intentions and my state of readiness, I noticed very little alteration in the cliff's aspect over the next several minutes. But then, quite suddenly, it was palpably nearer, and a smoother aspect to the ship's motion suggested to me that we were already in the irrevocable grip of the inflowing tide. I set down my pen, listening intently. The ship creaked and groaned constantly, but I had become accustomed to these mindless complaints, and had trained my ears to listen for the sounds beyond them. The footfalls, the calls, the individual accents and voices. and the complicated symphony of snapping, rushing, and rustling noises that attended some significant alteration in the disposition of canvas and rope. I could offer no useful description of any part of the process, but I could say that the noises fitted into a familiar pattern that I had begun to recognize, a reassurance that the work being done, while demanding, was proceeding in an orderly fashion. I heard Murgatroyd and the other senior officers quite distinctly, and while there was a seriousness to their commands and inquiries, I heard nothing of panic or concern in their utterances. Now and then von Voot interjected a remark, but the captain's manner was that of a man who had the utmost confidence in his inferiors, and was quite content to observe rather than direct. Presently, too, I heard the periodic calling out of soundings, as one of the men measured the depth of water beneath us. The cliff was near enough now that I had a much readier appreciation of its height and how greatly it loomed over the highest mast of Demeter. All at once I was struck by an overwhelming impression of the cliff's size and mass, and how utterly inconsequential our little prison of wood and sail was. It seemed, in a sickening reversal of perspective, that our ship was a fixed thing, almost the centre of the universe, and the cliff an implacable moving surface, an advancing shield of ageless rock against which we were about to be shattered, reduced to a few wet, ragged, and bloody human splinters.
"It will do you no good waiting here, Silas," Ramos said. "You are turning green before my eyes. Go above, and be assured I will be here when you return."
"If there are injuries," I rationalized, grateful, "it is perhaps better that I be nearer to the origin of them, so that I may offer the most expeditious assistance."
"That seems very wise," Ramos answered.
By the time I made it to the quarterdeck, the tide had borne us to within 200 feet of the inlet. A hurried shedding of sail was now in progress, requiring many hands both on deck and in the wind-whipped heights. Demeter had needed some portion of sail to guide its entry into the tidal flow, but now the race was on to reduce the ship to a skeleton of masts and crossbeams. Murgatroyd and his men were calling out with increased urgency now, and even the captain's interjections came more frequently. But still there was no sense that any sort of crisis was afoot. The crew had been trained to strike sail quickly when the weather turned, and all that was now being asked of them was to do it under somewhat milder circumstances. Von Voot was at the wheel, and now his interventions were becoming sharper and more rapid, as he sought to thread Demeter into the deepest part of the channel between the two opposing jaws of cliff. The soundings continued, and although I did not catch all of them, general impression was that the depth of water was decreasing, but not so severely as to cause alarm. No more than 100 feet now separated us from the opening of the inlet. Although the sun was still up, no part of its light reached us directly. The ship had entered the cliff's shade, and the inlet itself was at the wrong angle to admit any sunlight. The shadow brought an inauspicious chill to my bones, and with the nearing of the cliff sides, the air became heavy and damp, as if it lay draped across the deck like a funeral shroud. All at once, the voices grew muted, the calls less frequent. The distance to the cliff was now much less than the length of the ship. The soundings had ceased. There was no purpose to them now, given the speed of our passage. The walls soared to the north and south, black and glistening on their lower flanks, paler and mossy near their overhanging tops. Horizontal striations of rock called to mind books jumbled on books, a library tipped on its side so that the tomes pressed closest to the earth had begun to rot and mulch under the pressure of those above. I did not feel oppressed, though. Rather, I was giddy with the realization that this traversal would be over nearly as quickly as it had begun. Our speed was tremendous, and that was daunting, but the flow would be done with us very swiftly. I glanced at von Voot and saw concentration, but not terror.
"A wreck!"
shouted Murgatroyd, pointing off to port. I followed his cyclops gaze and saw nothing except water, cliff, and shadow. But my two eyes were not so well trained or acute as the one remaining eye of the lieutenant. He had seen what did not belong, and after lengthier moments I saw it as well, pressed into the gloom of the cliff like a mashed insect, and nearly indistinguishable from the hue and darkness of the rocks. It was a ship, indeed. There was not much left of it, merely the broken carcass of its hull, impaled so firmly against the cliffs that it was fixed there, insensible to any motion of water or wind. The stumps of its masts projected above the hull, attenuated to a quarter or a fifth of their proper extent, and over these wooden bones draped a mossy shroud of collapsed sail and rigging. I stared and stared, willing the ship to melt back into the shadows and become a mere phantom of perception. But it would not oblige. Murgatroyd lifted a spyglass to his eye and sighted on the hulk. He studied it wordlessly, then lowered the instrument. Steady on his feet, despite the angle of the deck, he walked back to Captain von Voot.
You should see the name of her, Captain.
She does not look as strong as Demeter.
I doubt that she was, but you should still see the name.
Murgatroyd, testing the limits of rank, nearly forced the spyglass to the captain's eye. Von Voot studied the apparition as silently as his lieutenant. I could only guess the object of their attention. To my eyes, the wreck was the colour of an old boot, and uniform in its drabness. Something near her front was drawing the captain's interest, though, some darker blemish against the rotten, weather-tormented wood of her bow. The captain lowered the spyglass. He turned to the man who had sponsored our voyage.
Master Topolsky, would you care to comment?
I did not say that they succeeded.
Nor did you say that Europa was wrecked.
The captain's voice was low and seemingly without rancor, and that was the worst part of it.
You led us to believe that these men did not come to grief.
I never claimed to know the fate of Europa.
Are you saying that you did not know she had been wrecked? That she met her end in the same inlet to which we are now committed?
How can you not have known, Master?
Murgatroyd asked rhetorically. Something broke in him, some reserve that had been under strain for weeks. A wild fury showed in his unpatched eye, rendered all the more vivid by its asymmetry.
By not disclosing this, he has violated the letter and spirit of our agreement, Captain. All is now void. While Ramos is indisposed, I strongly recommend that Master Topolsky be confined to his cabin and treated as a prisoner. As for the rest of his men, they must all be culpable. They each kept this lie to themselves. Lock them all up and let the courts fight over our contract.
What of survivors? The captain asked.
I cannot speculate, Topolsky blustered. I did not think we would sight this wreck. I thought it would be long beneath the waves instead of scrawled across that cliff like the writing on the wall. If it would not be visible, I was not required to mention it.
How many survivors?
Von Voot persisted. Then, to me,
now we understand why the men of Europa have not already made their fortunes with this discovery, Silas. They were too busy being drowned.
I don't know that there were survivors, Topolsky admitted, lowering his head. There may have been.
How did you come by your intelligence? I asked.
Exactly as I said. I came into possession of charts and documents.
Murgatroyd grabbed Topolsky by the lapels of his coat, as roughly as any thief.
Damn your evasion, man. What was it? Did you plunder this wreck? Did you feign ignorance as to its location so that we might fall for your game?
Topolsky wriggled in Murgatroyd's grasp.
Dupin looked on with a distant interest, as if observing a street brawl in which he had no personal stake. He still had that smudged ball of paper between his fingers, squeezing and caressing it like a charm.
Lieutenant Murgatroyd, von Voot said, your zeal is noted, but perhaps you would unhand our guest temporarily.
Temporarily?
Murgatroyd snarled,
releasing the master so suddenly and violently that Topolsky toppled back on his heels and had to flail to regain his balance.
Thank you,
the captain breathed. The intelligence, I repeated.
Her trunk must have escaped the wreck.
Topolsky was more red about the cheeks than usual and nearly out of breath.
I do not know the specifics. It floated on the outgoing flow and reached open water. Later it was found by another ship. The men from whom I brokered its purchase along with the contents.
His breath came hard and fast, like an exhausted racehorse.
They were simple fellows, with just enough wit to realize that they might make a coin or two from selling the trunk to me.
Why to you? I probed. He dismissed my question with a flap of his hand.
It is common knowledge among such crews that I will pay for nautical exotica. Charts, drawings, artifacts of mysterious provenance. Bring them to me or one of my aides, and you will be offered a fair price. I have people in every port of any significance. A great cobweb of influence with me at its throbbing heart.
A heavy, unsteady step sounded on the deck planks. I turned to face it with a desperate foreboding, certain that I knew its source. Colonel Ramos, you should not be about. He had seemed strong on the table and no weaker in the chair. But forced to walk, forced to move through the ship, his frailty showed. His face was pale, his eyes narrowed to a frowning squint, as if even the pale light of these latitudes was an affront to him. His bandaged head sat on his vast shoulders at an angle, as if it had been dropped carelessly into place.
I heard shouting. I could not remain below.
Approaching us, his eyes flashed from one protagonist to another, appraising our altered relations.
Thank goodness, Ramos, you have not forgotten your obligations after all. Colonel, said Murgatroyd, giving the other man a respectful nod. You and I have no fight.
Ramos answered mildly.
That is true, for now.
You rough handled me, Ramos. The man is no more than a common thug. Strike him down and teach the bog-trotting dog some modicum of civility.
I took Ramos's arm, feeling that the giant might vomit or topple at any moment. There has been a, misunderstanding, I said. I pointed to the wreck, already slipping away behind us. That is the wreck of Europa. He lied to us, Coronel. I'm as certain of that as I am that you had no part in this deception.
I did not.
Then to Topolsky.
Did you lie, Master Topolsky?
Concern yourself with knives and powder, Ramos, not the machinations necessary for greatness. Lying is the grease that lubricates progress. If the world were entrusted to truthful dullards, men would still be wearing animal skins.
That is how he thinks of you,
Murgatroyd confided in the coronel.
A truthful dullard. Throw your lot in with us, man. At least you will have the respect of your fellows. Is that not so, Captain?
A moment, Henry. I'd not heard von Voot address Murgatroyd by his Christian name, not even in the most avuncular of moments around his table, and the slip spoke to a moment of distraction on the part of the captain. Something had commandeered the greater portion of his concentration, something beyond even the wreck of Europa. We jerked. I nearly lost my footing. Ramos did lose his, for his sense of balance must have been precarious. Murgatroyd tried to soften the larger man's crashing descent to the deck and knelt by the fallen giant as Ramos vomited a frothy, pink-stained phlegm onto the planks. Then his eyes began to roll and flutter, and a quivering palsy took authority over his body. The captain wrestled with the wheel. We had hit something, surely. Perhaps the same submerged rocks that had done for Europa. I waited for the awful crunching as our lower timbers were ripped asunder. But nothing of that nature came. The ship was still moving like a thing afloat, with the relative motion of the rock faces to confirm it. What is it? I asked, torn between attending the shaking Ramos and the nearer terror of wrecking and drowning.
The rudder is not answering, von Voot told me.
Rather than making corrections, a touch clockwise, a touch to the contrary, he was spinning the wheel continuously, counterclockwise, as if he wished to make a sharp turn to port. But the ship's bow was veering in the opposite direction. The ship had become a dark compass dial, intent on pointing to the southerly pole. Some current or wind eddy, or combination of such factors, now toyed with us, and we could no longer keep a straight course through the fissure. The walls continued to constrict ahead of our motion. What had been easily traversable when the ship was moving bow first was no longer wide enough to permit passage. In an instant, the little contretemps that had played out between parties became an insignificant element of the larger drama now befalling Demeter. Ramos's fate was a mere detail now. Men were rushing about, obeying bellowed instructions and their own hard-won instinct for preservation. Some hands were scrambling back aloft with the seeming intention of restoring a portion of sail. I could only imagine that, with the incapacity of the rudder, the wind had become a potential ally rather than foe. Other men were unshipping large poles, several of them at each, and moving to the sides of the ship so that they could fend off the rock walls. But it was all happening too slowly, and the tidal flow offered no quarter. I caught the captain's eye for an instant. He looked at me, and between commands seemed to invite a question. "Are we in trouble?" He nodded.
"We are indeed in trouble, Silas. Will you help Colonel Ramos nonetheless?"
I had been stupefied into inaction, but now I remedied it. I threw myself down beside the shaking form of my friend. Murgatroyd had his head cupped between his hands, trying to prevent it knocking against the deck as the coronel thrashed. Blood spilled out between Murgatroyd's fingers, the bandage already as red as a banner. Ramos vomited again, and then the violence of his motions intensified, as if he were some immense shuddering machine which had lost its governing restraints and would now dismantle itself piece by piece. "He's choking, Murgatroyd!" Murgatroyd looked into my eyes, his own eye wide. It was not quite terror I saw in it, for I do not think men like Henry Murgatroyd permitted themselves the capacity for such an emotion, but terror's desperate near cousin, wild, destabilizing uncertainty.
"You healed him."
"I did my best. He was still weak and should have remained below." I had my fingers in Ramos's mouth, trying to clear the obstruction in his throat. It was like trying to extract a morsel from a snarling, rabid dog.
"Save him," Master Topolsky decreed, looking down on me. "Save the brute cold, or I swear I'll have you ruined."
Murgatroyd stood up with an easy, unhurried manner and punched Topolsky into a condition of instant unconsciousness. The swiftness of that transition was a thing of medical beauty, fit for the textbooks. The master fell, heavy and silent as a sack of grain. "Now I will have a broken jaw to attend to," I said, as Ramos bit into my flesh and our blood mingled in his mouth.
"Let me be the least of your concerns," Murgatroyd said, rubbing at his knuckles.
I followed his gaze along the busy deck to where a curtain of rock slid past the bow, nearer by the second. The men with poles were rushing forward. I watched them as if in a dream, wondering why they bothered. It was obvious that none of their efforts stood the least chance of success. The ship was too heavy, too ponderous, and the cliff moving too fast. One pair of men managed to project a pole out beyond the length of the bowsprit, but as soon as it contacted that moving surface of the rock, the pole was wrenched violently aside, injuring both men by the violence of the action. One man lay instantly limp and still on the deck, and the other attempted to scramble to his feet but could not, for some part of his leg was hurt. The other men with poles were less keen now, seeing how unequal they were to the task before them. Ramos gave a last violent shudder and then became quite still. I extricated my pulped and bloodied fingers and searched for a pulse. "He is gone, Murgatroyd. I could not save the poor man."
"Then save another if you can."
Nursing my damaged fingers, if they were not broken or dislocated, it was a miracle. I left the coronel and staggered forward across the deck, leaning against the sickening, veering angle of the ship. Was the ship as a whole in peril? I did not know. Trouble could mean several things, from the likelihood of imminent destruction to an inconvenience of delays and repair, costly to the accounts. But even if we were all about to drown, I could not have set aside my professional obligation to those men. I do not think I had covered more than half of the distance to them when the bowsprit met the rock and jammed itself into that irregular surface like a knife between ribs. I might have expected it to snap away cleanly, but I had underestimated the extent to which it was an integral extension of the ship's primary fabric. The main part of the bowsprit held, and the ship underwent the most violent deflection, accompanied by an appalling protestation of wood, a groan of agony issuing from the belly of the vessel itself. The deck tilted like the steepest street in Devon. Demeter had become a cruelly handled plaything, caught between the cliff and the tidal eddies. The deflection loosened men from the masts, now tilted at a considerable angle from the vertical, and they came down screaming and flailing. Depending on the height from which they fell, they met either the deck, the gunwales, or fell into the raging waters, where rocks could not have been far beneath. Those who entered the water were beyond all salvation, but I still felt an overwhelming compulsion to tend to the broken men on deck. Yet, as I surveyed the spectacle of injury and pain laid out under Demeter like some awful carnival, a paralysis of action overcame me. I knew my presence to be futile. I could tend to one or two of the men, perhaps, but my ministrations would account to nothing but a prolongation of their agonies. And which among the fallen should I favour with a surgeon's touch when all was nearly lost? Surely we were all done for. The ship writhed between rock and tide, and at last something gave way at the bow. Wood sundered, and the bowsprit broke apart, with one end still embedded in the cliff. Hope rallied with me. Damaged as we were, at least the ship had freed itself. If the tide could now bear the ship into the lagoon, even rudderless and with damage to her bow, repairs could likely be effected once we were sheltered from the wind and ice. Yet, with the severing of the bowsprit, the tensioned forces of the rigging were now fatally unbalanced. A sequence of failures attended, beginning with the foremost mast. Two-thirds of the way up, where two sections of mast were spliced together, the upper part broke away and came crashing down. Onto me. The mast smashed me to the deck. It lay across my waist, shattering bone and crushing vital organs. I knew this instantly and without the least shred of doubt. I could visualize the damage as plainly and dispassionately as if I gazed on an anatomical drawing of my own catastrophe. Rather than pain, I felt the lower part of my body turn numb. It was as sudden and shocking as the slamming of a door, silencing a quiet domestic conversation that had been going on, without ceremony, for the entirety of my life. I had become a house divided. I tried to breathe and realized that I could not. Through a reddening fog, von Voot and Topolsky came into view, leaning over me, exchanging words of consternation. I strained to hear their words, though, over the growing roar in my brain. A yellow form joined them. She leaned in as well, and even as the rest of my world dissolved, her face and voice were the last things to remain clear.
"Oh, Dr. Code," said Milady Cossille, plucking a feather from her hat and chewing on the end of it. "This dying really won't help us, you know."
Chapter 6. "A ship is a dream of whispers," the dead man said. "Whispers and dreams." So I dreamed. I found myself in the stone-walled tunnel again, without preamble or explanation, stumbling and groping my way towards a distant, feeble suggestion of greyish light. I was not cloaked this time, but encumbered by a suit of metal, the jointed armour of a knight. I shuffled against the tremendous resistance from each creaking, rusted articulation. I had felt that paralyzing weakness in many other dreams, and with that realization arrived a momentary chink of lucidity. This was also a dream, and since I was in it, I was also the architect of its narrative. I could submit to it, shape it, or break it. I had not the will. The lucid moment glimmered out like a star eclipsed by a darker body, or perhaps the distant sun, obscured by some little moon of Jupiter, Saturn, or cold Uranus. I shuffled on, striking for the light. It was not a phantom after all, but an opening in the tunnel, a wider part where paths branched off into deeper darkness and illumination fought its way down from above through a maze of cracks and shafts. An opening from which I might yet find a point of escape. The luster of the walls threw back my countenance. I stared at my own dusky reflection. The gleam of old metal, the beaked visor, the plume on the helmet's crown. I creaked up my arm and squeezed my stiff, gauntleted fingers against the visor. It lifted, but as grudgingly and grindingly as an old drawbridge. I stared into the void inside the helmet. The void stared back. There was blackness there, and for an instant I thought it a complete absence of form, as if the helmet were entirely empty. But I needed only wait for the light to worm its way inside. By degrees, a face emerged. It was not really a face at all. It was a skull, garbed in only the thinnest mantle of withered flesh. To the dream of whispers, I added a scream. Mortlock knocked before entering, and that was a mercy. I gathered myself at my desk, scraping sleep from my eyes, jamming on spectacles and in all respects attempting to make it seem as if I had not been asleep a moment earlier. I took up my fountain pen and went over the last line I had written so that the ink still shimmered. "Mortlock, come in," I said, raising my voice in glad fashion. He poked his head into my cabin.
"I heard a cry, Doctor, as I was getting near. Is all right?"
An exclamation of delight, dear Mortlock, and no more than that. In a flash, I saw my way through my current narrative impasse. I'm afraid I rather allowed my exuberance to get the better of me. I twisted in my bureau chair, wondering how likely any man would find my explanation. "I heard your footsteps and knew you were about to knock. What ailed you now? The abscess is still giving trouble?"
"Not that, sir."
Mortlock lowered his scarf and dabbed at his jaw, which, although raw from the abrasion of the wind and the scarf, bore no trace of its former swelling.
"You got at it very well, sir. Doctor, I mean. I hope I won't be making more work for you either, but I've been telling the other men how you knocked me out cold and how I didn't feel so much as a tickle."
"I am pleased. If knowledge of the ether's efficacy encourages other men to come to me with their complaints rather than suffering in silence, I shall be glad of it."
"Wouldn't that be a distraction from your scribbling, sir?"
Mortlock asked eagerly, nodding at my manuscript. "Quite honestly, I should welcome the work. The captain calls Demeter a lucky ship. He may well be right. Other than your abscess, Coronel Ramos's mishap, thankfully remedied, and a few exceedingly minor injuries, the butcher's bill has been very small indeed. Long may that continue, of course. But if the crew or our guests continue to abstain from accident and infirmities they have done, I almost fear that I will forget the rudiments of my profession." Seeing his immediate concern, I smiled over my half-moon glasses. "I do not mean that seriously, Mortlock, but it is good to be employed, is it not? On some other voyages, the surgeon of the ship has also been a naturalist or botanist, a very useful way of making the most of these months at sea. But the pursuit of knowledge is scarcely an option in these dismal, damp latitudes. The further we venture, the more my spirits seem to fade. The seas grow greyer, the skies paler, the procession of land more monotonous when we are in sight of it. Have you seen so much as another living thing since we rounded Cape Horn? His eyes went to the ceiling as he racked his memory.
A bird or two, sir, and I reckon a seal, although it was a long way off.
Slim pickings for a monograph, I think we can both agree. I put away my pen, stoppered my inkwell, blotted the manuscript and closed it carefully. What is it, Mortlock? We seem to run quite close to those cliffs just now. Has something happened?
It were a little touch and go, I think, sir, but we squeezed through quite handsomely in the end.
I frowned. Squeezed through?
Master Topolsky's fisher, sir, doctor. That gap in the cliffs the Russians been looking for. They found it last night. The captain took a look at the tides and winds. Mr. Fitzpatrick put some more anthracite in the boiler and through we went, easy as a greased rat.
He squinted at me as if one or both of us were suffering some temporary derangement.
Didn't anyone tell you what was afoot?
They may have done, I confessed, remembering how my mind had wandered at the last captain's table as soon as the talk turned to matters of navigation. Something about venturing into sheltered waters pursuant to something of interest to Master Topolsky.
You have it, sir, and no mistake. But I reckon you'd best hear the rest of it from the captain himself. That's why he sent me below, to bring you up.
A matter of medical concern? I asked, with some faint rising interest.
No, not that, sir, doctor. But you being a man of learning and all, and this curious Eddie face that keeps being mentioned.
I think that would be the edifice, Mortlock, I corrected gently, something of last night's conversation at last penetrating to the forefront of my memory. The spider-like blot on Dupin's map.
Dupin's map, sir? I'm not sure I've clapped eyes on any of old Yellowmop's maps. Very possessive of them, he is. Won't let him out of his trunk if there's another soul around.
Well, perhaps you were not there when the map was explained to us, but I remember the feature quite well, along with its apparent size. If it exists, even if it is a pile of rubble, it will indeed be the marvel of the age.
You don't sound all that bothered, though.
Oh, I shall be perfectly content if it is real, because then Captain von Voot will see some of that bonus he has been promised, and that will be good for Demeter and her crew. And I suppose I would not reject my share of that bonus either. But there my interest ends. There is no law that says every man must be driven by the same compulsions as his fellows. I looked at him astutely. What drives you, Mortlock?
Pie, mainly.
He reflected, a hand drifting to the shrunken belly he undoubtedly wished to fill.
And a little grog. And a tale, if it's told well. Like yours is, I mean.
You are too kind.
I'll let the captain know you're on your way, shall I?
No need. I shall be there quicker than you could possibly convey the word. Mortlock looked past me to the manuscript.
I mean it. By the way, it is good, and you ought to keep on with it. I'm sorry if I distracted from your writing by my knocking.
You did not, Mortlock. I patted the now sealed manuscript. Have no fear of that. The wind is in my sails again. I believe I may even have settled on a title. What do you make of The Stone Vigil, or The Edifice in Ice, a romance by Dr. Silas Code?
I think it should fly off the shelves, Doctor, when you've decided on which one it is.
When Mortlock was gone, I opened my desk drawer, tied off my forearm and injected myself with surgical morphine. Hypothetical edifice aside, the hypodermic syringe was a marvel of our age, as adept at administering curatives to the men as it was at furnishing my own steepening addiction. Thus fortified, however temporarily, I emerged into the cold low light of a sun that had only just had energy to haul itself above the cliffs, inlets and glaciers of Patagonia. We were creeping up the Pacific coast of South America, having rounded the Cape after sailing south from Montevideo. We'd been there for the winter, and the city had been unseasonably damp and overcast. Yet after weeks of perpetual stormy seas, lacerating winds and insidious cold, Montevideo had become in my memory a vision of balminess, a bounteous oasis of comfort, plenty and life upon whose quaint and colourful streets I would have gladly prostrated myself to kiss. My forearm still tingling beneath my sleeve, I surveyed our situation. Walls of ice-dappled cliff were peeling back on either side of Demeter. In the ruffled waters astern, they narrowed until nearly the point of closure. The dismal southern sky bit down into the cliff where a part of it had collapsed away, forming a neck of water between the sea and the saltwater lagoon into which we were now forging. The lagoon grew wider ahead of us, and the cliffs toppled back into gentler, if still forbidding, slopes of rock, ice, and snow. The inlet we had traversed was about 200 feet across, but the lagoon widened until there was a mile or so between its northern and southern shores. I could not see how far it extended inland, but that observation triggered another belated recollection from the night before. The lagoon was curved, and we had anticipated that a headland would block our sight of its inland, eastern extremity. So it proved. I could see the headland quite plainly, about 2 miles ahead of us on the starboard side. It was a skull-shaped mass of rock which projected from the lessening slope of the cliff. The skull seemed to be balanced precariously, as if it would not take much more than a gust to send it toppling into the lagoon. Von Voot and Topolsky stood by the wheel. Dupin, the cartographer, was next to them, and next to Dupin was Coronel Ramos, bandaged about the scalp, he wore nothing else on his hairless head, and showing commendable recuperation after his accident.
"Silas," Ramos said, nodding once.
"Good morning, Doctor," Von Voot called out. "Forgive me for summoning you. I know that this is not exactly medicine, but we did not think you would thank us for allowing you to miss it. Is that not so, Master?"
"Whatever suits cold," Topolsky answered indifferently, and I knew then that it was the captain who had thought of me, and perhaps Ramos, but not Topolsky, to whom I was but a complicating nuisance of his contract with Von Voot. I watched my footing on the deck as I neared the gathering.
"It's a charming lagoon, gentlemen."
"Not just any lagoon," Topolsky said, mirthful eyes twinkling in the narrow margin between woolen hat and scarf, the latter drawn over his nose. "This body of water is on no chart in the possession of any maritime power, past or present. Save for our own maps, it is totally unknown. And yet, here we are, beholding it with our own eyes. Consider yourself fortunate indeed."
"There is water," I admitted, "and rocks and some ice, and quite a lot of sky above us.
And that headland is, I suppose, of some distinctiveness." Topolsky shook his head in disgust.
"Exploration is wasted on you, Cold. Your imagination has turned in on itself through repeated misapplication. Mere fiction has no place in this bold new world of ours."
"I shall bear that in mind." Topolsky turned to the young cartographer.
"Dupin, any hint of our quarry as yet?"
The sharp-featured young man averted his eyes from the curious optical instrument he wore on a strap around his neck. It consisted of two squashed telescopes joined side by side, spaced the same modest distance apart as his own close-set grey-green eyes.
"No,"
he reported, and went back to his observations.
"What is that thing you look through?"
I asked.
"A pair of binocular telescopes," the young man answered without looking at me. "Porro's recent patent, but with improvements in prism collimation by Erbrucker."
"Only the latest fruits of science for our expedition," proclaimed Topolsky, as if he was still trying to drum up sponsorship.
"While we scheme on everything else," Ramos murmured.
"I trust the passage through the inlet did not disturb you too badly?"
Von Voot asked, fingering the stiff projection of his moustache.
"I would not have wanted to chance those waters without the assistance from our marine boiler, but in the end we came through with very little difficulty."
I am very glad to hear it. I did see something of the cliff getting nearer, but I presumed that if it were of concern, I would have been informed.
There was no real prospect of accident, Von Voot said. Which is not to say that we did not take all precautions, nor that we should be any less alert as we proceed into the lagoon.
Will we sail all the way to the edifice? Monsieur Dupin's chart looked very detailed to me, but only you will know whether we can sail all the way east, or must make part of our journey along the shore. Topolsky complained to Dupin.
I thought we agreed not to disclose the confidential charts until we were safely within the lagoon.
Dupin levered his binocular telescopes away from his eyes. His cheeks were sunken, the color of ruined milk. His cheekbones stood out like a pair of treacherous mountain ridges.
The topographic chart remains in my care. To have seen it, he would have needed to go through my sealed possessions.
Coming from any other man, such a suggestion would have been grounds for an immediate and unconditional apology, followed by a demand for satisfaction if that apology were not forthcoming. I knew better than to hold Dupin to such standards. He could not help himself. He could no more control his tongue than other men could control the beating of their hearts. There was no intended provocation in his words, merely an assertion of the facts as he saw them. I did not, Monsieur Dupin, I said levelly. I have a clear recollection of seeing the chart on the captain's table over sherry and cigars. I believe it was the same evening that I advised you to take more rest for the sake of your health.
A similar chart, perhaps one of our own, interjected Von Voot diplomatically, offering me a way to save face and trying to keep the peace between his guests and Demeter's newly hired physician.
Murgatroyd and I marked up several of them by way of speculation as to our objective. Doubtless it was one of those that you saw.
I nodded keenly.
Of course it must have been.
Dupin went back to his scouting. Topolsky gave me a cautious look, while Ramos only frowned, making no judgment except to signal his unwillingness to take a side.
In answer to your very reasonable question, Von Voot said, we will likely not risk Demeter anywhere near the shore. But in the calm waters of the lagoon, far from the tidal rush near the inlet, it will be perfectly practicable to go out in the boats. If the topography of the shore permits, Murgatroyd can arrange for the setting up of a camp so that the boats do not have to come and go unnecessarily.
Will Silas join us? Asked Ramos.
Von Voot must have already considered the question, for his answer was immediate.
If the doctor is not overburdened with work on Demeter, then it would seem the most sensible arrangement in case of sickness or injury among those who go ashore.
There is no if about it, Topolsky said. It is there in the contract. Where there is a conflict of work, Cold is to give priority of treatment to the expeditionary party.
My priority, I said, would be to the man most in need of my care.
Then you will place your captain in forfeit of his obligations.
Gently, Von Voot said,
I am sure there need be no disagreement and no need for us to put contractual matters above Dr. Code's commendable scruples.
He leaned in confidently.
Besides, it may be to your advantage, Silas. A few days on dry land away from seasickness and the confines of Demeter would do wonders for your constitution.
I smiled. Has my retching been that obvious? Topolsky scoffed.
Had we known our surgeon would be prone to seasickness as well as flights of fancy, we might have cast the net a little wider than the barbarous hovels of Plymouth. I allowed myself to think you were related to the Exeter Codes, Code. I thought that with the money that has flowed to that renowned and respectable family, we could be sure of the caliber of your education. It was a mirage.
I am not responsible for any assumptions made about my name, I replied. Besides, I am related to Lady Code. I believe I may be a fifth cousin or something similar.
A fifth-rate cousin on a fifth-rate sloop. How apt.
I would not be standing here if Silas was anything left than capable in his heart, Ramos said.
You, Ramos? Topolsky asked scornfully. I would not be so quick to use you as a benchmark for Code's capabilities. You have been soft in the head since he drilled into you. Why do you not defend me when our contract is reduced to a legal mockery?
I see it, Dupin said.
See what? I asked.
The edifice.
You see it? Topolsky asked disbelievingly. Preposterous, Dupin. We haven't even begun to round the headland.
Nonetheless, I see it.
Dupin's voice was as barren of excitement as if he were dictating last year's news.
There is a projection above the headland.
Topolsky snatched the binocular telescopes out of Dupin's fingers and jammed them into the slot between his hat and scarf. He swept them around the massive obstruction of the headland until at last something caught his eye.
Good grief, Dupin.
Now you see it, the cartographer stated.
I see what I think you also saw. A finger-like gray projection like the top of a tower. But it cannot be what it appears.
That skull-shaped mass of rock must loom 800 or 900 feet above the lagoon. If there is something beyond the headland which rises up enough to be seen over it, then it must be taller still. There is no possible ambiguity.
May I view it? I asked. Dupin still had the binocular telescopes looped around his neck, but his faintly trembling hands lifted them off for my benefit, and he watched with some visible concern as I peered into the eyepieces. A wheel lay between them for adjusting focus, similar to the arrangement on a microscope. The headland was sharp through the excellent optics. I tracked along its barren, mossless upper edge, the gleaming grey crown of the skull, so to speak, until I detected the protrusion the other men had already observed. It was very small, hardly more than a vertical grey sliver, like a solitary fence post standing sentinel atop a hill. I confess, gentlemen, that I cannot easily discern the nature of the object. Were I to have stumbled on it for myself, I might easily have dismissed it as being nothing more than a vertical stone resting atop the headland. Dupin patted a prickly line of sweat from his brow, dislodging a curl of yellow hair that had fixed itself there.
It moves.
It what? I asked.
Our relative motion is what he means, Topolsky said. We are yet under steam, albeit progressing at only a very low rate of knots, the captain's wise caution prevailing, and yet our movement is enough to differentiate the projection from the headland. It is a little like the effect of parallax, whereby our astronomers determine that one star is not in fact at the same distance as another. The stars do not move, but the Earth does, as it wheels around the sun. We are the Earth.
I nodded slowly. I see now. The little finger was inching along the skull from right to left, but one needed to watch it for several seconds to be confident of the motion. And, yes, I see by implication that it must lie at some higher point than the top of the headland. Higher and more distant. But it could still just as easily be a natural pinnacle of some kind. I passed the binocular telescopes to von Voot. Captain? He did not seem to have been permitted to handle or examine them before, because his fingers lingered over them for a moment before lifting them to his eyes. I wondered if he thought them a fancy, inconsequential toy, but was too polite to say so, or whether he coveted them over his own old but rugged spyglass. He looked through them for a moment, then passed them back to Dupin. Ramos said nothing, and it was obviously agreed among the Topolsky party that this distant glimpse was of no interest or concern to the soldier.
"I do not know what it is, to be sure," von Voot said. If it is a tower, then it must be at least 1,100 or 1,200 feet above the lagoon. If that is an indication of the size of your edifice...
But he permitted this wild conjecture to go no further.
We shall see soon enough when we no longer have the headland in our way. I think about 2 hours will be sufficient.
We shall commemorate the moment, Topolsky said. The light is fair, the deck not moving around too much.
You mean to make a photograph?
Captain von Voot said, with
with the air of one who has just realized his worst fears. Topolsky's eyes glittered with sudden enthusiasm, the lines around them deepening to ravines.
We must move with the times, gentlemen, or rather, since I shall require quite a long exposure, we must ardently not move.